All right. Welcome back to the Catch Bits Show, everyone. Thanks for joining us. And we've got our usual cast of characters back together again. This is one of the co-hosts, Mike Moran, and I have Neil Pinchard with us. Hi there, Neil.
Mike, Jason.
Greetings. And hey, Jason, Richie.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
It's going well.
Good.
What you up to in the shop these days, Jason?
Summer's kind of finally winding down, so I found a little more time in the shop here the last couple weeks, so... for myself, I have been working on a two-blade Warren Cliff Trapper Bose pattern, so just getting ready to wrap that one up, and I got a few other knives to work through, and then I'm going to start cutting some stuff out and doing a few knives for the Tennessee show in Nashville, and see where that takes us. I might do a little Damascus. Might work on a little Damascus, ooh. Mike.
Oh, fancy pants.
Yeah. Yeah, a little stainless Damascus.
You know? Hmm. Hey, have you got that trapper handy?
Yeah, I got the trapper. It's right there.
Oh, you showed me that.
It's got a little emerald
really
green
pretty.
Paper on there. Yeah.
Emerald just green.
How much would you pay for that? About $7 for the covers?
I can't tell you.
You got it for that cheap? $7? Man, hook me
I
up.
I might have got it a little cheaper than that.
Wow.
It came from another knife maker who I would consider a friend, and he offered up plenty, which was very generous of him, and in return, I sent him a little bit of what I had extra of back.
That's a great color. That reminds me kind of the British Racing Green. It just has that kind of deep, cool green color that's...
It's pretty unique, Neil. It's kind of the hot item right now as far as my card goes.
It should be.
It's hard to see in the light, but there's a lot of marbling in the micarta itself. So there's some black, black, but darker hues.
Yeah.
It just looks marbly. But when you... This is only 400 grit right now.
Hmm.
So I will take that up to probably 1,500 2000 and then buff it, and it'll really, really shine.
I like the shield down there. Do you guys have a name for that specific shield?
That's the Keystone.
It's like a skinny version. It's not a Chatton Morgan version.
It is, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, it's like thin.
I prefer that version. Now, I built a single blade Gents Trapper with just the clip blade for myself 2 years ago. And I put that shield in it because I thought it looked really good. And so now I've been putting that shield in quite a few of this pattern. I like it. I like it a lot. It's my favorite. And there's a few other guys out there that follow me that really dig it too. So, and then it's got, you know, etched A2 blades, which turned out pretty good. So really happy with this knife.
All you have to do is buff it and you're done?
Oh, no. I gotta grind all them pins off and then give it a good... once over all the way up through the grits and then buff it and take the back spring down a little bit, just clean that all up, and what do we do from there? Probably put some edges on it. We're good to go.
Folks listening to this can't see the knife, but it's interesting for me to see Jason's knife, and it's pinned together. The pins haven't been ground off yet. To see a knife like that that's essentially almost finished. Where my knives, I go about it such a different way. Like, my knives are so rough when I beat them together. And then I go about the chore of hafting them to whatever grit I want to go to. But, you know, my knives are at 60 grit and just somewhat rounded over. So it's always interesting to see how different people do it.
It has been an evolution, Mike. I will tell you, for probably the first year when I finished... when I finished my covers or my handles or what have you, I would do almost all the way to finish and then put the knife together and beat it together and then go back through that process. And then I just had this epiphany, like, why am I doing this twice? This makes no sense. This is stupid. Yep. You know, so you're right. You do kind of get a little wiser in how you build. Like, don't try to do too much at one time, you know, just kind of,
yeah,
really you just do a little bit. Really the biggest thing with building these knives is, you know, getting that action set up, getting them blades ground, after that, it's just little bits at a time.
You got that thing nice and thin. What thickness are those liners?
These started out as 40 thou, and then I surface ground them down to about 35 a piece. Overall thickness on the outside scales are about 124 is what I measured them at. So the whole thickness of the knife is coming in at 471 thou. Turned out nice and thin.
Super carryable.
Perfect pocket carry.
I don't know if that's a word. Yeah.
Yep.
Great job.
I really pushed myself on the thinness front of this one. As you evolve and, you know, keep going with knife making, working on your thinness is a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely is a thing.
Yeah. Get the, you know, you can save probably even a little bit more, go down to 20 thou in that middle liner if you're feeling frisky. The problem is if you're mill relieving it, it makes it tough to mill relieve.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not much. There's not much there. No. So
you might cut your finger on the
Yeah, relief arm. I know. Yeah. I know.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you got going on? I seen you posted up a beautiful sway back today with some beautiful jig bone.
Yeah, I've been in the natural material kick lately.
Good for you.
Trying to get the stag to comply to my will right now. I'm sure Jason knows what I mean.
Yeah.
I ground it was big chunks, and I ground it thin, and I was dipping it, and I was just rushing, and I glued it, and now it's all bowed. So you just gotta wait it out.
Yeah.
Lots of clamping power and time, you will defeat that thing. So just waiting it out right now. So
yeah.
We'll check it tomorrow. I got it clamped, and I got two other knives going right now. I don't usually do that, just one at a time for me, but just kind of how things worked out. So just been cranking the stag and the bone. Yeah, I've been sitting on this whole drawer full of stag, which is super costly, as you know.
Yeah.
And I actually pulled off some stag off of a knife today. I got it all done, and I was looking at it. I'm almost ready to pin this thing together, and I just wasn't happy with how the stag matched. Even though it was a matched set of stag, it just didn't look good. And you have that all the time. When you cut an antler and one side's much different than the other side, it happens. And it happened here, and I just didn't like it. So I took one of the pieces of stag off on the pile side and rooted around my drawer till I found something that matched pretty good. And it was the same kind of good popcorn, and then started the whole process over again.
It's a pain, isn't it,
Mike? I mean,
it
just you lose a whole, you lose a half a day.
Stag is such a pain. I can't, and we all love it. We all love it. I mean, when you can pull it off and it's amazing, but like Mike said, I seen Mike's stockpile, and I have a bunch in my drawer over here that I don't even know. Like, I keep looking at it, and you're like sizing it up as you're turning it and looking and trying to figure out
how it's going to fit.
Yeah. And sometimes you don't see it. And I know on the last knife I did with stag, I was just like, screw it. I'm just going to start grinding it down, and we'll see how it looks when I get it there in close. And I got down to that point, and I'm thinking, not too bad. This might work out. So I certainly have about 20 or 30 pieces in my drawer here that would say otherwise, that just didn't make the cut.
It's a bit of an artwork, and then there's the whole bending process of it if you have to. Because for the listener, we can get stag in multiple ways, but usually you get it in rounds or it's already been slabbed. And either way, it's expensive already, and then you've got to put a bunch of labor in. And when you get it in slabs, they're only, let's say, they're usually an inch to an inch and an eighth wide.
If you get inch and an eighth, you're getting a thick one.
Yeah, you know, and by the time you thin it down, it oftentimes, because it's rounded, it doesn't cover the liner. It's not wide enough to cover the liner after you thin it down.
Yeah.
So it's like this whole like crazy, like you're always eyeballing it as you grind it, trying to thin it. You're trying to take some from this side or this side or work corner to corner, you know, trying to get this thing so that you've got enough left when you're done thinning it down to cover the whole liner.
And you can get creative. You can kind of like I'll put it in my disc, and I'll I'll shave it at one angle, and how much do I got to take off on this so I can get that corner of the end of the knife on there and the handle.
And then you're trying to like, well, where are the pins going to, where are they going to fall on this thing? Can I get them to fall between two pieces of popcorn or in a ridge, just to make it look good?
Or your shield.
It's a lot. Yeah. And your shield. And the shield's tough. I got to get some thicker steel and make really thick shields so I can get it into the big popcorn.
Yeah.
Because what happens is if you got big popcorn or big ridges, if you're dealing with a 60 thou shield, by the time you get a pocket in there, it's so deep, you're grinding away the top of the stag.
Yep.
Yeah, I gotta look around for some thicker shield material.
I will say that's where the pantograph is worth its weight in gold, because it is still a chore to get a shield into stag. Having that pantograph and being able to just, that cutter is going where that template is, versus when you put it in my clamp and you're trying to do the outline and it's everything is wonky, whereas it's flat on a pantograph, if that makes sense. So it's only
absolutely.
You guys imagine doing that with the old parser's tool, with that thing strapped to your belly and a big old bow drill, and you're
Jason's basically doing it. I mean, what he's talking about the old way would be, it is a parser plate.
Yeah.
It's just not with a bow drill. It's just with a
Dremel. Press.
Yeah, but I'm thinking you got a big gnarly piece of stag, and you got this thing sticking out of your belly button, basically, and you're running this bow back and forth, and that thing must be jumping all over the stag. And yet those guys, when it was all said and done, it looked beautiful.
I can't imagine that tool working.
I know.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, you have to imagine. There's plenty of videos out there.
There are.
Stag is definitely
a violent old process.
It's a love hate, man. Especially if you're a maker, it's a love hate.
You know, that bow drill and the parser plate's the way to go, though, because that's so much faster than what we do with a pantograph. I mean, you think about the amount of time it takes just to cut the shield on a pantograph, and then you got to lay everything out. Put your liner down and with the handle material on and get everything centered up and monkey around with that, then cut the pocket. It's so much faster with the bow drill. You eyeball it with the kind of pinch the plate to the handle and stick it in a vise and just go to town on it.
I have to think that back then stag was probably a little more plentiful and easier to come by, where, you're going bow drill and you screw something up and you're like, pull it off, throw another piece on.
Yeah.
Pull it off, throw another piece on until you finally get it.
Yeah, it wasn't like those things were epoxied on anyway, you know?
Yeah, here we're paying 50, 60 bucks for a set of stag and you're like, God, I don't want to ruin this,
Yep.
Yeah.
Ruin many.
So I got a good stag story then, real quick, since we're on that kick. So at first I was told about this hack and it was big hush hush. And then I went to a couple knife shows and I'm seeing these things laying around all over the place for $70 a pop. So I'm like, you know what? I'm done keeping it a secret. So anyways, I'm one of these guys that gets on eBay every once in a while and I'll buy some of these old, carving sets. Mike, you know what I'm talking about? You know, these old Solingen German carving sets, and they got stag handles on them, and it's a crapshoot, man. You'll see one on there, and you might get a decent price for it, 40, 25 to 50 bucks. And you get it, and it's like maybe one piece you can use or whatever. But so anyways, I bought two sets last week. I found two sets that looked amazing. And I paid $52 for the first set. It showed up 2 days ago, and I opened it up, and it's the best one I've ever gotten. All three pieces were giant. They were big rolls, beautiful texture, just jackpot. So I had another one show up yesterday that I thought was going to be even better. And I paid $80 for this one. And then that's the most I've ever paid. I get that and I open it up and I'm like, this isn't stag. It was plastic.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, it looked, and I've looked at a lot of these, this thing looked legit.
Yeah.
I thought I was getting a really good one. So I messaged a person on eBay who was not accepting returns, and I'm like, hey, listen, this is not stag. This is plastic. And they go on to tell me, and, you know, here's a set that's plastic, showing me pictures, and you should get an expert with a loop and maybe look at it a little harder. And I'm like, with all due respect, I have a loop. I am a knife maker. I'm buying this crap to put on knives.
Yeah, but you need a watchmaker's loop. That's different.
Here is a legit set. Here is your set that's plastic with the seam running down the side where it was molded together. It's plastic.
Did they advertise it as stag?
Yeah. Otherwise, so I don't think I'd have got my money back.
Right.
So, anyways, word to the wise, get your loop out and be very cautious when you're...
And you get your loop out and look at those pictures on eBay real closely.
I almost got burned. Almost got burned, but oh well.
Yeah.
It's the price you pay.
I think the listeners can expect some cheaper stag knives from you now that we know you're getting stag at a nice price.
Yeah.
Hopefully you'll pass those savings down to the customer.
Yeah.
You won't stiff them.
2024 is coming up. Vote wisely. Maybe that'll drive the interest rates and inflation down. And, you know, us starving knife makers, we can charge less for our hard-earned hard work. And, you know, everybody else will be happy. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you think voting in elections matter, go ahead and do that. So you got this stag. And we've all done it. And you said, like you said, it's not a secret. People talk about it like it's a secret. Mm-hmm. But and you go to any knife show, somebody's going to have a box of stag pulled off of carving sets and big forks and stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I've been to two knife shows now where literally the table was littered with these things. And I'm thinking, what? Why is this ain't no secret? Give me a break. And if it is, whatever.
The secret's out now. Neil, I know you're not running a shop, but I did see in the latest issue of Knife Magazine, this would be the, I've got it in my hand here, August 2023 issue, that you and Jack Black are at it again here with another article.
Yeah, I've written several articles with my great friend Jack Black from England, and Jack is just a tremendously good writer. He's a good historian, but he's just a great writer. So it's always a treat. I made a comment the other day that he really brings my level of articles up because of his skills and his talents. But yeah, we wrote an article on English Boy Scout knives. I thought it was pretty interesting. When you think of our American Boy Scout knives, you think of the typical camper knife. You think of usually the four blade or the six blade with the punch and a can opener and a bottle opener and a screwdriver and a main blade. But in England, even though they made those knives, those weren't Boy Scout knives. The Boy Scout knives were always a one blade sheep foot with a big old marlin spike on one end, which were really copies of the British Navy knives. So it was kind of fun to go through all my catalogs and all the stuff that I had access to find out that was really the primary knife for the English Boy Scouts. But anyway, it's all in the article, and I hope people go out and buy a subscription to Knife Magazine. Also, you don't have to buy the physical magazine. You can get a subscription, yearly subscription online for a pretty reasonable price. I think it's only $10.
Get the magazine. It's worth it.
Get the magazine.
Come on. Get out of here.
Yeah.
It says $9.95 on it on the front cover. Yeah, that's a great article. We won't spill the beans on that anymore, I guess. But
no.
It is very fascinating that most of those English knives are sheep's foot, obviously, because, you know, most useful blade design should be the only blade out there, maybe. It's arguable.
It sure is arguable.
And a marlin spike, which I'm sure those kids weren't practicing knots with. They were sitting there stabbing each other.
They were stabbing everything in sight. Yep.
On those marlin spikes, I've never operated or held a knife with one of those. Does that thing have is there a spring on it?
They do have a spring. Yep. When they snap shut, they get a strong spring, and snap open, they're locked open pretty heavy. And the marlin spikes are thick. I mean, they're generally the size of a pencil, of a number two pencil, but they were just super useful in rope work. So when you think about the Navy or even the Army use those same types of knives. So you're constantly tying and untying your tents and your horses and lashing things. So the marlin spike was used for untying knives, but at sea it was also used for tying certain, tying knots, also used for tying knots and ropes. And if you think about the Boy Scouts, the same thing, especially early on, you know, they had ropes for everything. They're, you know, stringing up their tents and their backpacks and all kinds of stuff. So it was a really useful tool for working with rope.
Does that spike then, does that come out at 90 degrees like they're pictured, or is that thing going to come all the way?
Folds all the way out just like a blade would. And typically that's how you'd use it. You'd fold it all the way out and then use it like you would a blade and then use it with ropes.
I'm just kind of thumbing through the article. I got my subscription, I don't know, early last week, and I haven't really looked at it too closely yet. Haven't had a chance, but I am on a page right now where there is a beautiful one with a stovepipe kick by C. Johnson and Company.
Oh, yeah.
Really, really cool knife. So, yeah, you're going to want to get this article or get this magazine and check it out for sure.
And other knife-related news, I think we've alluded to it in at least one or two previous podcasts. We thought we'd talk a little bit about the David Hayden Wright auction that took place back at the, I think it was at the end of June, right, Neil?
Yep, that's right. Held in London. And David Hayden Wright was a big-time collector of English knives back in the early 2000s and before then. I never knew the man. I never had any conversations or communication with him. But I just through his book, I was aware that he had a really good collection of knives and a good knowledge of English knives. So it was an interesting story in that he was a collector, and I believe sometime in the early 2000s he started writing a book. He had the book partially done, and then he passed away in 2008. So the story that I was told was that his wife and a friend or two of his finished putting the book together, and then it was sold thereafter. It was actually published through Schiffer Publishing, which is an American company. That also kind of surprised me, but I was told by another friend that Schiffer has a pretty good reach around the world, Germany and a lot of Europe. So they have connections and they have partners they work with. But anyway, the book then came out in 2008, just after David had passed away. A big, thick, heavy book, long out of print now, so it's kind of hard to find. But a lot of wonderful pictures, a lot of good information. You know, it's like any book. There's some things that may not be quite right, but there's still good, valuable information and a lot of things that you won't see in other books in there. So anyway, a few years after David had passed away, I called and contacted a few friends, especially overseas, and said, hey, whatever happened to the knives and the ephemera that David had? And my friends wrote back and said, we have no idea. It's been put in lockdown. So here, just a few months back, this auction pops up with the David Hayden Wright collection, which was kind of interesting that meant that from 2008 until now, I guess 16 years, those knives have just been sitting with the family, you know, boxed away. So what a company in London then auctioned off the knives, and it was pretty exciting. Mike, I know that you watched the auction while it was happening.
Yep, I watched the auction. It was live, it was online, and you could watch each item come up. It was kind of like being at a real auction. You could watch the item come up, and you could watch the bids start happening. You could see the calls. You could see the final bid, and on to the next item. That collection was so big that I feel like it started, I want to say like 9 a.m. Eastern, and I know it was like after lunch by the time it ended. It was a long auction.
Right.
This collection had everything from that book, and I'm guessing then more some, but fixed blades, tons of exquisite Sheffield pieces, buoys, hatchets, lots of pocket knives from multi-blades to beautiful, even exhibition pieces, wall displays, a few pattern books were there. The bidding was fast and furious, and lots of little collections, you know, like a Barlow collection, a collection of this, collection of that pattern, collection of that maker, and that type of thing. And it was quite fun to watch. I think we purposely didn't talk about it on the podcast because at least one person on this podcast was bidding at that auction. So we did not speak of it.
Wasn't me. Wasn't me, Ben.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't.
It wasn't it you. Wasn't
your,
me.
Your two broke knife makers. Yeah.
I did bid on some things. I actually have a son who's living over in Scotland currently, and I tasked him with bidding for me and gave him some some items I was looking for, and he did a good job in securing some stuff for me. Like Mike said, there was such a wide variety. It was really an interesting auction. And some of the stuff I thought went for anywhere from a fair to a cheap value, and some stuff just went through the roof. I mean, through the roof meaning there were many knives that sold for well over $10,000 each. There were a lot of group knives, too, which kind of surprised me. They take like a whole group of pruning knives or other pocket knives. I mean, there might have been 15, 20 knives in a group. And if you broke down the individual price for what the lot was, they were a steal. So I think whoever bought some of the group stuff, they're going to do real well when they go to sell those off individually. There was also some really cool knife boards, meaning that there was a cardboard or a wooden board that would have had all the knives attached to it for a display. And there must have been, at least 6, 8, maybe 10 of those different boards with knives on them. I mean, those were really, really interesting also.
Yeah, they were. And not something you see very often. I don't know what you consider this, but this kind of like once in a generation type of auction that occurred. These pieces, there were a lot of fantastically preserved pieces there, and that was a fairly substantial collection of English, good English stuff. So I don't think we see that very often, do we?
No, I agree 100%. This was a rare auction in that there were not just a huge quantity of knives, but the quality was really up there. He had some really exceptional pieces. You know, you'll see a piece here and there, and we all know purveyors that come up with a good knife now and then, but to see this many knives at one time was really a treat just to see, to watch. So yeah, it was cool.
How is this thing formatted, Neil? Is it kind of like watching it on a television, you know, for some of these car auctions where they're just showing you a knife? Or they got them laid out on a table and they're showing you the table.
And actually, I didn't watch any of the auction. My son was watching it and bidding on it on the phone. I was working that day and I was in communication with my son all day. We'd be talking on the phone back and forth. But I think Mike would be better to describe what it looked like. I never saw it.
Yeah, as a viewer, you could see the item. So there was a catalog that was put together by the auction house beforehand. And then the format of the auction followed, I believe, that catalog in sequence. And so it would just display the item or items. And then bidding would begin. You would see the bidding happening on like a window pane to the left or right of the object. And you could see bids going. If you're registered to bid, you could just sit there and type in whatever and bada bing, bada boom. It was pretty slick, Jason. It was fun.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun to watch. It was, you know, some of them were going super cheap, actually. Also, for us Americans, there were taxes and fees to be paid. So that was a consideration as well as far as the final price of the item. So
it
things
was
were going
actually,
cheap.
Yeah, it was actually a big consideration, Mike, because if anybody was serious about buying something, you know, if a knife sold for $1,000, well, right off the bat, they had a 30% buyer's premium. You got to tack 30% onto that. You have to pay some of their taxes. You have to pay shipping to get the knife back here, which can be pretty expensive. And you have to pay your duty fees once it hits American shores. So I had figured that you're roughly anywhere from a minimum 50% higher than whatever you think you're going to bid. So if you're going to bid $1,000, that knife's really going to cost you $1,500 or maybe a little bit more. It wasn't cheap that way. I feel like the auction was run both well, smoothly, and I thought it was really on the up and up. You know, sometimes you'll see auctions, you think, man, is there shill bidders out there? And they running up the prices on things and you don't know. You know, fake phone bids or fake people in the audience. I didn't get that feeling at all, mostly because I think a lot of these knives went for what I consider less than what they were worth, and they all
That's
sold.
Right.
There was no reserve. Everything sold. So I thought, boy, this was a really an honest, you know, up and up auction.
Yeah, it was very professional, and they put out this nice catalog beforehand, and bada bing, bada boom. It went fast. I mean, it was like fast and furious, but there was so that collection was so big, it just took hours.
Yeah, how many?
So
how
I just
many
had
total
it up.
Knives?
I had it up while I was working, and I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of
really
of knives were sold.
Wow.
Yeah, and like Neil said, some were in like small groupings of anywhere from like 4 to 20, 25. It was neat, and there were a lot of amazing, you know, if you're a fixed blade guy, there were a lot of amazing fixed blade knives. There were fixed blade knives with folding pen knives coming out of them. There was something for everybody in that auction, I think, but all good English pieces.
I don't know if I, maybe I didn't hear you guys right or wasn't listening or what. I don't know. I recall having a conversation about that. I wish, Mike, next time something like this is happening, I want to check this out. I want to log into this thing.
I'm not going to tell you. I know we're friends, but we got to make sure I get
the best price. Hey, dude, are you listening to this? Are you watching this? You.
You're the first one I'm going to call when it's over.
Well, listen, I'm not bidding. I'm just watching. But
I guarantee there were 30 other guys keeping their mouth shut about it.
Oh, it's funny because since the auctions ended, I have talked to other friends around the country that all said, oh, yeah, I was watching that, or oh, yeah, I was bidding on it. And it seems like everybody I've talked to since all knew about the auction. So if you were, you know, kind of in the world of antique stuff or English stuff, you pretty much knew what was going on. And you weren't telling your best friend either.
I just want to check it out.
That's right.
Listen,
I just
want to check it out. Come on. I'm not here to snake in on anybody. But I'd like to check one of these things out once.
Well, we'll see, Jason. There's a certain amount of trust that has to be had there.
Well, maybe one of these days I'll be in the circle.
There are auctions that happen all year round in America that aren't knife auctions, but they're auctions that happen to have knives, guns, other things in them. I've had buddies for years tell me about great items that they've found. And a lot of these guys, they'll just search out auctions. So they'll go online and search out, you know, general auctions all over the country. And it takes a lot of work, but it's no different than searching for things, you know, on the internet or on eBay or whatever. You know, if you're diligent about, you know, going after something and keeping a track and keeping an eye on what's going on, you might find a rare item that very few people see.
Where I'm at here, there's a lot of little antique malls and stuff.
Right.
Live around the Galena, Dubuque area, which is, you know, they're older towns here in the Midwest. And I do, on occasion, stop in at some of them antique malls and just wander around and see if there's anything in there of interest. And if I see estate sales or something like that. But to this day, I don't think I've come across anything of note still hunting. Just, I think it would just be cool to come across something. I almost thought I found some ivory once and it was chalk or something, but
I think you're looking for love in all the wrong places, Jason.
Yeah, right.
Well, that was a little bit about the David Hayden Wright. If you're listening and you got to watch it, that was pretty neat auction. It's kind of bummer that was over. When it was over, it was kind of a letdown. It's like, wow, it's over. Like I said, it's once in a generation type of auction. I feel like I don't remember this big of a collection, at least in the last 10 years coming up. I don't know. Am I wrong on that, Neil?
No, you're right. There hasn't been anything there. There was some stuff that was sold about 10 years ago that got split up to a couple different purveyors that came from a big collector. But that's been about 10 years ago now. Well, I don't think we can leave the show without having a little bit of truck talk.
Oh, yeah. Jason, I've been seeing on your Instagram stories, you've got you got tonneau cover mania.
Now, you got to tell me, because I don't look on Instapod. I don't have an Instapod account, so you guys are going to have to tell me.
You've got to get an Instapod. That's a good way to look at photos.
We had chicken soup in the Instapod last night. It was amazing. that stuff is done in like 30 minutes, ready to roll.
Yeah.
My wife loves the Instapod. She's always cooking up something good in there.
Yeah, yeah. We know, Neil. You probably couldn't even figure out how to get the lid off.
I can barely make toast. I'm serious.
You have to let the pressure out first, Neil. You don't want to just go unscrew that lid. You might end up wearing it.
I wouldn't go anywhere near that, no. I can heat up things in the microwave, that's it. Jason, now I heard you got the big boy. I heard that the little guy just wasn't enough. And you stepped
up. Oh, yeah.
Let's bring the listeners up to speed with, you know, when you're rolling in Jason's kind of money, any truck you want on the lot is yours.
Did you buy a Tundra?
The taco wasn't enough for you?
Listen, I still own the taco, okay?
Okay.
I'm a taco guy. My wife now I'm just the little guy here. My wife went out and bought a Tundra.
Okay, she was embarrassed to ride around in your taco?
Yeah. Is she taller than you, Jason?
She is now. She is now
in that big truck.
You've got the Taco. What year is this Tundra?
It's a 23. Wow. It's the 1700 edition, whatever year that was, but 94. Hmm.
1794.
Okay, so
that's made in Texas, right? 1794. And yeah, is this one of those new hippie turbocharged?
It's got the iForce Max in it.
So it's a Prius.
I'm telling you right now, that thing is no Prius.
It's a Prius. It's got the same technology stack.
It's 450 horsepower, Mike. It makes our little Tacomas look like toys. It's a monster.
Is there a ramp that you can park your Tacoma up on top of her Tundra then?
Yeah, I can fit my truck.
What length of bed does that Tundra have?
It's a 5.5 foot bed in that one.
Oh gosh, it looks ridiculous. It has no bed on it.
It's much wider, much deeper. Yeah. There's a lot more room than our Tacomas for sure.
And a full back cab?
Full back cab. Okay, so little backstory here. So we pull a lot of vehicles now with the campground. So we're always pulling these golf carts around. We have a side-by-side I'm pulling back and forth. We have a tractor. She's picking up pool equipment for the campground. She's just always hauling stuff. So, and the Tacoma does not tow well for those of you.
No, it does not.
It's a great truck. I have been driving a Tacoma since 2006. I've owned four. I will never not own a Tacoma. That being said, we had a need for a full-size truck, and I will not buy a Chevy that gets 12 miles a gallon. I will not buy a Ford because I don't like rainbows, you know, and I'm not driving a Dodge because I like to drive my truck for more than a year or two.
Boy, we haven't offended anybody.
Truck wars.
Now.
Here we go. Yeah. Here we go. So,
just lost 42% of
our
listeners.
Off the cuff mentioned, you know, trading in the Tacoma to get a Tundra. I really like my truck, and I just got it last year. So, anyways, her 4Runner was getting higher in mileage, and it's, you know, we had it pretty well paid off, and so I convinced my wife to take a look at a Tundra. And the dealership, you can't get Tundras. You can't just walk onto the lot and get one. Not around here, anyways. You got to be on a waiting list. And so the dealership had called and they said, hey, we just got this brand new one in and the financing fell through for somebody. We know it's more than what you're looking for, but if you'd like to come take a look at it, blah, 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 blah.
Somebody showed up on the lot and realized it was a Prius.
Yeah, yeah. And so we showed up on the lot. And it had everything that Natasha wanted. She got in that truck and she was driving it. Had brown, you know, Softex interior, which is what her 4Runner had, and had a great big giant sunroof. I mean, this thing is just loaded to the max. So, anyways,
so it got one of those like 25-inch displays in it.
Yeah,
too?
Yeah, it's got a big screen TV in it. So we were driving it to put our name on another one that was coming in. It was a premium TRD, and this was a 1794 TRD without running boards. I don't want them running boards. So she's like, wow, I really like this truck. And I'm like, well, for the difference of what we're paying or what we would pay, just get the one you want. Get the truck you want and don't have any regrets. So
I agree.
So she went all in and yeah, she's got a big truck now.
Oh, so you're blaming this on her, this Tundra? Gosh.
Yeah, it's all her
fault.
What's
the mileage? What's the fuel mileage on that with the little battery?
I haven't seen that thing below. Now, the battery, I don't know exactly, Mike. You're probably more read up on this than me. It's like a generator. It's between the engine and the transmission. It's a battery generator. I haven't seen it go below 18 miles to the gallon. So we're probably averaging 18 to 19 with that. Yeah.
That's not bad. That's about what I get in my Tacoma. Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah. Yeah. I'd say the Tacoma, we're getting about, 18, 19 if we're not driving. You probably get better than me, Mike, because you drive like grandma.
Yeah, I grandma drive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and in addition to that, I did the whole truck bed cover search. For any of you guys out there that have looked at bed covers, you know it can be a rabbit hole in a, of itself. So I ended up buying two Paragons for both trucks. Paragon is a company out of Wisconsin, all U.S. made, pretty nice bed covers. So I spent last week installing them. That's my story.
Is that a roll up, fold up? How do those work?
It's pretty unique. I think they've got kind of the only deal going on the market as far as what they offer. So this thing is it's all aluminum, and it rolls up like an accordion.
Oh yeah, I've seen
it. It's panelized, right. So it rolls into the truck bed, and then when it's all open, it's about 8-9 inches wide, taking up that much of your bed. And then it can clip out. You can actually take it out from the frame and then store it, you know, so you have full use of your bed. So for what we wanted, lockable, you know, hard, all that, so it just fit the bill. Plus it's US made, and you can't never go wrong there. So
there you go. There's no perfect cover out there, though.
There is not.
They're all trade-offs. Yep. They're all trade-offs.
Yep.
I've got the roll-up soft cover, you know, with the round bars that go across.
Oh, my gosh. That's a hot mess. That's too
much. No, I've had it on for 10 years. It rolls up nice, and then I can roll, you know, motorcycles, dirt bikes, kayaks, because it rolls up right tight to the back window,
real
basically.
Tight. Yeah.
Yeah.
I that's what I like about it. But as far as security goes, there's no security.
Yeah, like I said, it's all trade-offs. I have the Toyota Tacoma actual tri-fold hard tonneau cover, and it's great because you just reach in, there's a lever, flip one panel, flip another panel, flip however many panels you want, but it doesn't roll tight. But there's no separate locking mechanism. If your tailgate's locked, it's locked. Pros and cons for each one.
Yeah.
There's no perfect one that's been invented.
Yeah, I've been pretty happy. Mike, I sent you a couple videos. They operate a little differently on the two different trucks. The one on the Tundra went on pretty easy. Everything lined up, and then there was on the Tacoma, man, you had to do a lot of alignment and a lot of goofy stuff, but once it's on, so it's all good.
It's probably your truck's all bent up, your
Could
frame's
be.
All bent.
Could be, yeah.
So quit driving that thing so hard.
100 mile an hour everywhere I go, man.
Gosh, does that thing go 100? I've never even had it up over 80.
When it's by itself, I don't know how your truck is. Mine's pretty zippy.
I love my Tacoma, but it's the most ridiculous pickup truck. If you really need a pickup truck, that's not it. I've got four-wheel drive in it, and if you have four passengers in there, so you got five occupants, the effective payload capacity of the bed with my running boards on and the tonneau cover is 345 pounds.
Yeah.
See, the problem is, Mike, is you're going by what the book says, not by what some guy like Jason or I would do.
Right.
Hey, these engineers, they've got their slide rules out. They've figured all this stuff out.
I don't read books.
Yeah. More than once, I've had that back filled with books, with dirt bikes, with sod for the yard, and hauled people in it. So whatever the book says, I just kind of ignore that.
What year is yours, old? What year is yours, Neil?
2011.
Second
gen. And I have had that thing, filled in the back.
Okay, so I'm the guy.
The newer ones are much heavier.
I've owned a 99 SR5. I've owned an 03 TRD off-road. My last one was a 2009 TRD off-road. And then now I've got the TRD Pro, an 18. That 2009 had more towing capacity. I don't care what the book says. Had more towing capacity, and you could haul a lot more than you can in my 2018. Well, it had a 4-liter engine, too.
Yeah, bigger V6. And not this ridiculous 6-speed transmission.
Yeah, that 6-speed sucks. That thing sucks. I'd lock mine in the fifth
gear. Yeah, it's no good. It is a dumb way to save a quarter of a mile to the gallon. Dumb way. Hmm. Well, for all of our international listeners, we're talking about the Toyota Hilux, basically. The American version of it. Maybe not as cool.
Not as cool. They can get diesels in theirs and
turbo diesels, I guess. But stuff. The turbos come into every vehicle. Turbos and hybrids, everybody's getting them. So if you want a good old fashioned vehicle without a bunch of bells and whistles, you better hurry up and buy it because there aren't going to be any companies making them anymore.
That's another reason why I decided to keep the Tacoma was because I'm still running a full gas engine, right? Which now the newer gen that they're getting ready to come out with is that iForce Max 4-cylinder, although it's pushing about 380 horsepower or something, isn't it, Mike? Something like that?
Yeah, Four-banger pushing 300 and
twin turbos
horsepower. Yeah. I wonder what the cylinder pressures are. I bet
it's a bad idea, in my opinion.
I don't think you're going to get a half a million miles out of that truck.
No.
I really don't, that new one.
The dealership was tripping over themselves to get my truck. I kind of figured if it's worth it to them, I'll just keep it because it'll be worth it to them 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now. They always, I've never lost on a Tacoma. Believe it or not, I have always made money on every single one of them trucks.
I think I may have told you guys, but I had a buddy who sold a 2008 Tacoma with 350,000 miles on it. He sold it for $8,500.
Sure.
And I said, you're friggin' kidding me.
Yeah, that's a good deal, actually.
350,000 miles?
Sure.
He could have got more money for it than that.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, in this market?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. When we traded our, we had a 2011 4Runner SR5 that we traded on the 18 that my wife owned. When we traded that car in, we had 200,000 miles on it. And if you looked on all the blue books, it said it was worth about $10,000. And the dealership come out and said, we'll give you 13. I mean, we didn't. We were
from
like,
the dealer. Wow.
Yeah, we were like, yeah. Really? Okay. Yeah, sure. Even the financing guy, when we picked up the other 4Runner, he's like, I can't even believe we're paying this for this car. I'm like, yeah, me neither. Thank you.
Huh. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch all this. You know, Toyota's not what they used to be, in my opinion. Just everybody calm down about your opinions, but it's my turn to share mine. And I think they're just like any other company. It seems like planned obsolescence is a thing in the car industry now. First it was the phones, then it was the appliances. Now I feel like it's in the car. Like people know, like car vehicles with cylinder management, that's an idea that's cool on paper, but it doesn't work in the real world. Mm-hmm. Nobody's figured it out. Shouldn't buy a car that shuts off its cylinders while you're going down the highway.
Yeah.
You shouldn't do it. There's too many bad things that can go wrong. And I almost feel like by now, all these manufacturers know that. So they're going to get you worry-free, you know, up to 150,000, 200,000 miles. Then they want you buying the next one.
Yep.
They don't want you going 350,000, 400,000 miles.
Yeah, and you certainly can't maintain them like you used to be able to, you know, with all the... Yeah. Gadgetry they got in them and all that.
Yeah, either. I mean, my truck doesn't even have a key. I wouldn't even know if the button stopped working for the ignition. I'd be chasing wires for a day trying to figure out how to do it.
That 99 that I owned, my first Tacoma, I sold to a guy here in town. If it weren't for the fact that, you know, he let his kids trash it, that truck still runs. I mean, I've contemplated buying it back just to put a little money into it and get it back going again, but.
Yeah, first gen had like a box frame to it. Yeah.
Yeah. I had that thing checked up to the day that it ran out of that 15-year warranty for the rust warranty, and that thing passed every single time. You know, looking at it myself, it passed every single time. That truck's a solid truck, man.
Well, this has been Truck Talk.
Truck Talk on the Catch Bit Show.
Hey, if you got bored with this, tough tittles. That's kind of how what we talk about when we're talking with each other.
I mean, if you ain't driving a Toyota, then you need to do something different.
Hey, now hold on a second. To be fair to people that aren't driving Toyota trucks around, some people have to haul stuff. Some people need to pull stuff. And you ain't gonna do it with the Toyota truck.
They should get that Honda Odyssey thing.
The Ridgeline.
Yeah, that's a man's truck.
Oh, now we just make people.
I'm pulling your man card right now if you're driving a Honda Ridgeline out there. If you're a dude driving a Honda Ridgeline and you call it a truck, your man card is revoked right now.
You're fine if you're drawing driving the Ridgeline. Hey, we got no problem with you. But if you're to tell us that's a truck, that's drawing the line in the sand there. No.
Yeah.
I don't know what you call that vehicle. But when you have like a trunk underneath your bed of your truck, like that's not a truck. If your tailgate swings open, not drops down, also not a truck.
Yeah, we are in so much hot water, aren't we?
Oh, gosh. Send all your emails to Jason Ritchie.
Bring it.
I don't even know if he has email, but send them over to him.
Bring it.
And he'll answer them. I'm sure he'll answer them politely. and pithily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't send them if you want your feelings hurt, man.
And next week we'll talk about how, you know, those big truck makers, they were selling to both the Americans and the Nazis during World War II. So yeah. We can settle that Ford versus Chevy argument once and for all. They both are terrible. One of them's worse because they've got the big gay Ranger.
Man, they're going to be real terrible if they just go to these electric engines like they're trying to make them all do.
They have those trucks here by us. They're $110,000 for the Ford Lightning.
Keep them gas, man. Keep them gas. You're kidding yourself if you think that these plug-in vehicles are the answer. You're kidding yourself. You are an idiot.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, we hope you enjoyed a little bit of our banter tonight. Yeah, knife makers talk about trucks. We're not the only ones. There's all kinds of knife makers out there that talk about trucks when they're not working on knives. So there you go. Now you know. Secrets out. If anyone's even listening this far into the podcast, hey, we appreciate you sticking with us and all your support. Hope you got a little bit out of that. And we'll talk to you on the next episode. Take care, everyone.